Hello, hello, hello. It's Ari Rosenbaum, soon to be joined by Dan Venturi. It's another fun-filled episode of that 401k podcast. This week's episode, we're going to talk about major misconceptions that plan sponsors have about their 401k plans. Well, actually, really about their retirement plans, because there's some concepts that interchange with other retirement plans, such as defined benefit plan and profit sharing plan, and about the two people who still have a money purchase plan left. So it's going to be a really fun filled episode. It's the last one we're recording for the year. So when you're going to be listening to this, it's going to be 2019. So happy new year. And I'm back with Dan Venturi. Dan, how are you?
I am doing well, Ari. How are you?
Well, with the kids off for winter break, I could be better, but going to see a lot of movies and went to see a Broadway show last weekend.
Good. Which one?
I belong to TDF, which is that because a sole proprietor, you get get online some cheaper tickets, like $50 Broadway show tickets. So we went to see School of Rock last Saturday night before it closes. Oh, so it was fun. I mean, it's not memorable like Carousel or Chicago, but it was a good show. And the seats were terrific for $50 a pop. They were like row E to the side in the Winter Garden Theater. So it was a lot of fun. Seen a lot of movies.
Isn't that where Cats played forever?
Cats played forever. Then after that, I saw Mamma Mia was there for a very long time, for like 13 years. And School Rock. And School Rock is closing for Beetlejuice. There's going to be a Broadway musical on Beetlejuice because, God forbid Broadway turns out any original shows anymore. It's all based on a property,
Yeah.
Because they're selling the tourists. And you could tell the tourists in the crowd.
I think they're doing the Beetlejuice 2 as well.
That's been on the drawing board for years. I don't know whether they're going to do it or not, but that's been talked about. End of the year, people with last minute stuff, that's always fun. And of course, a lot of work I don't have to do now because the government shut down, so I don't have to deal with some IRS and DOL agents.
There you go. Well, which is a wonderful point. Do those 45-day letters, does there any effect on that?
I don't think yet. I mean, if the government still continues to be shut down, maybe, but I can't imagine that it's going to be shut. Well, I mean, the 45-day letters that have expired or in the midst of expiring, you probably have a shot at. But the ones that are still outstanding, until it expires, and if the government shut down, obviously they're not going to take action on you.
Well, let's see what happens when they reopen for 19 with a bunch of new characters.
Yeah, I guess. So anyway, this week's subject, we're going to talk about major misconceptions plan sponsors have about their retirement plans. These are based on articles. One article in particular, I think I originally wrote it for my old law firm, when I worked at Meyer Suozzi. I guess on the podcast I can mention it was Meyer Suozzi, English & Klein. And then I used it again for my old law firm. I used that topic again. Really, plan sponsors having misconceptions. They have no idea about their plan. Things that they, assume to be true and are just really not. So we're going to go down the list. In no particular order, but one major misconception I think that plan sponsors have about their retirement plans is the idea that they can handle the plan by themselves. I mean, I don't think that there are many plan sponsors that do that, but there are people out there who don't think they need a TPA. Years ago, I worked for a small lawyer who was an accountant also, and he was working on the retirement plan, a profit-sharing plan for the employer, and he had no idea what he was doing. So I can imagine there are probably a handful of plan sponsors that think they could handle administration in-house when they really can't. They don't have the background for it. Or they can be the advisor on the plan by themselves. They don't need an advisor. I always talk about Meyer Suozzi's plan. I'll get more dirty looks for it when I joined them as an associate. again, the story goes, 10 years they didn't have an advisor on the plan, and the fun lineup showed. So that's one big misconception that, you know, plan sponsors think they can go it alone and handle plan administration and all aspects of the plan on them, by themselves.
Yeah, that's a tough road to travel, and not one that, you know, I would hope, you know, companies above a handful of employees wouldn't ever dream of trying to travel down. You know, it get professionals to run your plan. There's a lot of liability. A lot of things can blow up. When you're doing it yourself.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the aspect, of course, thanks to the internet and thanks to, you know, some, you know, cheap online brokerage, you know, we know that we can invest on ourselves, but when we have a ERISA retirement plan, which are covering employees, there's more to being an advisor than just picking funds. You know, it's the investment policy statement, it's managing and reviewing the funds and giving participants education. So that's one aspect where, you know, we know that they can't do it by themselves. But, you know, again, they don't understand what a TPA does. They don't understand what an advisor does. So they could think they could do it themselves, and they can't. Another misconception is that the plan sponsor thinks that they don't need an ERISA bond, and especially they don't need fiduciary liability insurance. And I think another misconception is the plan sponsors think that they are one and the same. So, again, an ERISA bond, all plans that are covered under ERISA need a fidelity bond to protect the plan assets from theft by plan fiduciaries. That's different from a fiduciary liability policy, where if a plan trustee gets sued, the policy is in place to protect them from personal liability, from legal expenses. And, you know, those are two big concepts. ERISA bonds required, fiduciary liability is not. But in my opinion, a plan sponsor should get both.
Well, and considering how inexpensive fiduciary liability is, there's no reason to not have it, right? Most businesses hate unpredictability, right? And that's what insurance helps provide, is some certainty to addressing a risk. And you know, if you can mitigate a risk cheaply by buying, or as cheaply, by buying fiduciary insurance, it's something that it's a must have.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I had a client years ago. They were a union, and they got sued in a class action lawsuit. And, you know, $1 million of legal expenses. Thankfully, they had fiduciary liability insurance, and they were only out $100,000, which was the deductible. So, I mean, that's a big to-do. In terms of ERISA bonds, I always talk about the client that I had who was a defined benefit plan. They put in all their money with Bernie Madoff, $3 million, and they didn't have an ERISA bond in place. So, poof, you know, you're limited to you know, whatever the trustee recovered, which, you know, was a good amount of money. But, I mean, it could have been catastrophic. And, you know, the plan was already under DOL audit, and so that was a big to-do.
Well, the other thing, too, I mean, I thought we mentioned this on prior podcasts. If it's not in the 5,500, that's a red flag.
Well, absolutely. If you answer no, don't be surprised to get a call in a year or 2 years from later from the DOL looking at the plan or the IRS, but most likely the DOL, because it's a DOL rule and a DOL requirement. So, you know, that's what I would do that. That's why it's, again, it's something that plan sponsors really need to be aware of, need to know the difference between the two. One's required, one's not, but they should get both. Next one is that professional – this is going to be the most controversial one, probably one, my opinion. That professional firm has to be good. My TPA recommended them. It's the idea that, again, goes back to my days working for TPAs. You know, when you get a referral sometimes from a TPA, especially like some professional services, especially auditing firms, that's to me a concern. Just because a TPA refers them doesn't mean that they're particularly good or great. But that's the thing with any referral. You know, listen, I've made referrals as an ERISA attorney, and, you know, 99% are good, 1% blown up in my face and made me look bad. But you should never just assume that because a professional services firm in the retirement plan business is referred by the TPA doesn't necessarily mean they're great.
Yeah, no, entirely. My wife, we had a bunch of electrical work done, and the guy is great, and he's cheap, and she happily referred him, right? And it worked out for the people that had since used him. But anytime you go out and essentially, a referral is essentially vouching for someone, right? I mean, it just goes by a different word. If that goes south, there's going to be ramifications, so it's definitely something to pay attention to, right? Scrutinize the referrals that you get and understand the potential liabilities that come with that aren't necessarily monetary, but they're definitely reputational.
Right.
Your point.
Next one is, we don't have to worry about plan design. You know, the plan sponsor doesn't really have any need to worry about plan design. And I think that that's one issue that so many plan sponsors don't really understand. And not caring about plan design leads to inefficiency, leaves to, in my opinion, a lot of money left on the table that could have been used to maximize contributions to employees, that could have cut down on their tax liability. And, you know, it's one of the biggest concerns around. So, you know.
Yeah. And we've talked about it in the past too. I mean, it's funny how a lot of these are themes that we've had, you know, in the past few months that we've been doing this. Take advantage. Make sure you as a plan sponsor, as an advisor, you know, use that TPA, use the ERISA attorney, whoever's, you know, looking at your plan, drafting your documents. Use those folks. I mean, make them earn their money. It's going to bring a lot of value to you as a plan sponsor and as well to you as an advisor.
Yeah, I mean, there are too many 401k plans that have a plain vanilla comp-to-comp plan design or an integrated and maybe, a cross-tested new comparability allocation, maybe safe harbor, maybe something in tandem with a cash balance plan. And again, but a plan sponsor just not caring about it. They're just, in my opinion, wasting money that they could use for retirement savings for the highly compensated employees.
Sure. Who inevitably, you know, unless it's a safe harbor plan, are going to get some sort of limitation, right?
Right.
I mean, I've got folks that are seeing, some of my clients are seeing, you know, they maxed out their contributions and they're seeing refund checks north of 15 grand. Right. So that's a problem. Right. It's the non-discrimination is it's discriminating against another group, right? In this case, it's just the tyranny of the majority, I guess, right? So we're benefiting the many at the expense of the few. To quote Ari's, this is it, Ari. I've been waiting for this all year, as long as we've been doing the show.
What, Star Trek 3?
Is this Star Trek 2?
Well, 2 and 3. I mean, you know, I've actually, I have a love for Star Trek 3. It's not as good as 2, but I think it's the underrated movie out of the original six Star Trek movies. But yeah, the needs of the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many.
We did it. That's it. It's a bucket list item. We made the Star Trek reference.
Well, you know, I still think stealing the Enterprise. I remember when I first had, years ago when I was in college and you could buy videotapes, movies, and I had Star Trek 3 before the DVD to cut, you know, to just search out that stealing the Enterprise scene. I think that's one of my favorite scenes in any Star Trek movie, when I actually steal the Enterprise.
They steal the Enterprise and kill the chase vehicle, right?
Well, they booby trap the Excelsior.
Yes, exactly. You know. Scotty took the bolts or something from the new warp drive.
The trans warp drive, yeah.
Trans warp drive. There you go. So, guys, that's it. I mean, we made the Star Trek connection. I don't know what we can do from this point on, but.
If we could try to put in a Beyond the Poseidon Adventure reference, I think that would be funny.
But we'll try. We still got another half of the show to do. So.
So next on my list is the broker advisor picked those funds years ago. They're still good. And, of course, that's a knock against my old law firm's plan. You know, I look at that list. I'm an associate. I knew a thing or two about funds because, you know, when you're dealing with 401k plans, you're dealing with a CPA, you kind of know what was in fashion at the time. The time, I think American Funds was still the hot-to-trot fund company at the time. That's going back, 10 years ago. I'm looking at the fund lineup, and American Funds aren't on that lineup. It's these funds that, you know, I knew were long-time go, very highfalutin funds in the late 90s. And I said to Pat, the HR director, who picked out these funds, our ERISA partner, who's no longer with the firm, he picked them out 10 years ago. And just because, what was good then is not necessarily good now. Listen, when I started the business, everybody wanted to be in Janus funds. I remember working for a TPA and Janus 20 was closing its doors. And, you know, the TPA had to twist arms to get some money into the Janus 20 before it closed. And, of course, this was before the late trading mutual fund mess with Securities Trust and all that kind of crap with Spitzer and whatever. But, yeah, just because a fund is good now doesn't mean it's going to be good a couple years from now. And it's important that plan sponsor as an advisor that they work with can review the fund lineup every 6 months, every quarter, whatever it is, depending on the size of the plan, and seeing that, you know, what's good now is still good. Because again, in our experience, you know, mutual funds don't really stand the test of time. Index funds do, but not actively managed funds. So, you know, that's just really the time reference. Times change, things change, and it's important that there's a constant review, a constant process in place to make sure that the investment lineup is still prudent for the plan participants to select from. A next one that's a goodie of mine, it's something way, way back, nobody really cared, but expense ratios, the plan sponsor doesn't have to worry about it. And expense ratios, to me, I will always remember when I started in the 401k plan business, working for TPAs, the misconception that if we use index funds, they are more money. Not realizing that expense ratio do matter. Plans that have higher expense ratios can afford to pay revenue sharing. And that was something that nobody ever considered years ago, but now they have to, thanks to fee disclosure. But expense ratios were never mentioned, were never factored in when pricing was considered for a 401k plans administration.
Oh yeah, those days are gone. I mean, any advisor that's listening knows that. I mean,
you know, the advisors know that, but the plan sponsors still may not know that. And then, no, I'm sure that there are quite a few out there that don't.
You're right, Ari. No, in that regard, you're right. And that's an opportunity for the advisor. Right, to bring the news, so to speak, you know, from the front back home.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. What's the next item?
Next item. That's the flip side where the plan sponsor only wants low cost funds, and you got to look for prudency. Just because they're the cheapest funds out there, don't pick them because they're the cheapest. I think focusing too much on low fees is a problem too. It's the flip side of it, and it's something to consider looking for the investments that are really the best fit rather than just what the expense ratio, whether it's low or it's high.
No, precisely. And getting assembling an investment lineup is almost like assembling a wine list. I was in a restaurant yesterday and looking at this thing, and the guy's got 50 different bottles of wine from all over the freaking world. And it's like, what are you throwing darts?
Right.
Same thing with investment lineups. There are thousands of mutual funds. You want to make sure that you're getting the best. Not necessarily the least expensive, but the best, right? You'd always pay more for a return. So, again, that's something plan sponsors, advisors, everyone involved needs to understand. It's not a race to the bottom. You want quality, and you shouldn't be afraid to pay for quality with something as important as your retirement.
Absolutely. Next one on my list, the advisor is great. He's my cousin. That's the idea. I always hate that. Mainly, I was always a big. I didn't like nepotism, even though, you know, sometimes I've, for summer jobs, I think nepotism kind of worked out for me when I was a kid, but I've never been a big fan of nepotism, and especially the idea when you're dealing with fiduciary issues, selecting your cousin as the advisor just because they're your cousin or your brother or your sister or your father, it's a big no-no. When selecting any plan providers, it's got to be really a rational process and a fair process. And juicing in somebody just because, they're your relative, it's a recipe for disaster. And, you know, coming from my family's experience, anytime family members have done business together, it's been a big disaster. I had one uncle who had no college education, was a screw-up at business. The other uncle, who was wealthier, they were brother-in-laws, and he had a quick he had a great business dealing with doing military hats, and he got bored by it, so they went into the indoor amusement park business.
That's a natural segue. I can see it.
Exactly. They got involved with some people that were really unscrupulous. They first went into a restaurant, into a indoor amusement park in Union, New Jersey. Then they got in with other, people. They had an indoor amusement park in Langhorne, Pennsylvania, down the road from Sesame Place.
Yeah.
And it just blew up. It was badly managed by the people that, one uncle had it hired, whatever. So one uncle blamed the other one. They didn't talk for 5 years. So, I don't think doing business with family is a good idea, especially when dealing with fiduciary issues, especially dealing with, liability issues. You want to pick somebody who's the best at what they do and not because they're juiced in. Charity begins at home, I guess, whatever they say, it's nice to help some relatives out, but by giving them that kind of slot as a plan fiduciary or as a broker, it's just a bad idea. Or is it even a TPA? It's just a bad idea.
Bad idea for everybody involved.
Exactly. Next is one of my favorite topics. I just wrote a revision to an article about this. The plan investments are directed by employees. So the plan sponsor is free as a bird. The idea that one of the biggest misconceptions, ERISA 404C, if I give my participants some mutual funds to select, I'm not liable for any losses that they sustain. Forgetting the fact that it's a process and it's got to be a prudent process they have to put in place. And that means, having an advisor, having an IPS, reviewing investments, replacing them when they're bad, giving education plan participants, that's part of the 404C process. You have to give plan participants enough information for them to make informed investment decisions. And saying good luck to them with a Morningstar profile isn't really the way to go, or giving them nothing and just saying good luck to you. That's just not the way, the way it is.
And that, you bring up a really, really interesting topic there. And I'm sure we can spend, a podcast or two on it. In the definition of 404, the part about reasonable education, there are two things that I always, back in my diligence days, it used to come up all the time. One, brokerage windows. Can you ever reasonably satisfy that responsibility, liability? And two, what extent of education would satisfy that?
Well, I've written articles about it. I hate brokerage windows. And the reason I hate brokerage windows is because I don't think that it's part of a prudent process. And the question is, you can't really exempted out of the plan. When you're a fiduciary, you're a fiduciary of all plan assets. So it's like a plan fiduciary can't just look in just ignore the brokerage window. They actually have to see what people are investing in the plan and have discussions with them. The plan participants that is in a double inverse Chinese ETF or some other crazy investment and put in all their assets with that. To me, you actually have to have a discussion with them. And they're a bigger headache than anything else. And I always used to joke, I said the only plan sponsors that put in a brokerage window are attorneys, accountants, and doctors.
Yeah.
And it's just, to me, too much of a headache. And then the concept is, you know, I worked at a law firm, I'll bring that up, that, you know, didn't offer me a brokerage window, and I know they were available. And then there's a problem that in that plan, one of the big highfalutin partners had their own broker attached to their plan assets. And that's a big mess, especially when you had an advisor to the rest of the plan, that advisor that I, you know, helped, you know, I get, you know, tell them that they needed. And it's a big mess. It's a big liability risk. And one of these days you're going to have a participant who's going to sue, and they're going to say, you know what, you didn't give me education, you didn't give me any background, I lost all this money. And the question is, are the plan sponsors liable? You know, to me, a court will figure it out. And, you know, to me, with court, once you're in there, you're very lost, whether you win the case or not. And that's why I always say, don't bother with it. But, you know, you're dealing with people who, again, want it. So it's hard to say no.
Well, so take it one step further. On a regular plan, what's the education level? Access to the website? I mean, what? Is there anything plan sponsors?
I think you need to have that sit-down meeting. You have to have the enrollment meeting / plan education meeting. You got to make sure people attend it. You should keep an attendance sheet, and you should also keep the materials that were provided to show, you know, that's part of the package. This is what I did to satisfy 404C.
So essentially have some sort of annual dissemination of information, whether it's a meeting, a webcast, something.
Yeah, exactly. And memorialize it that you actually did it if you're the plan sponsor.
Got it.
And, of course, the biggie on my list is always, we don't pay anything for plan administration. I mean, that's really gone out the window thanks to fee disclosure. But there's still plan sponsors who assume that they're not paying anything because, you know, they're not paying anything. The plan investments are paying for it somehow or, you know, in some fashion.
Yep.
And that's a big danger when you're dealing with fee disclosure because, again, we live in an environment where you have fee disclosure. You actually have to become aware of you know, what's being charged and whether it's reasonable or not. So here's another one. This is another one I love. There's nothing wrong with picking provider that will benefit the plan sponsor's business. So, I always found it with banks. You have a line of credit with the bank, and then you hire the bank to be your advisor because the bank has an advisory service, or the bank is the TPA.
Yes, sir.
You know, so, you know, I have this line of credit and, you know, I'm going to go with the bank as my TPA or as my advisor. I think that's a recipe for disaster because in my mind, it's a prohibited transaction. You can't have a transaction that will benefit the plan sponsor. And if you hire the bank that you get that line of credit for, that you're hoping to get that big loan with, that could be a problem. That could be dicey if it's ever discovered. We had that with recently was a class action lawsuit, I think, with Oracle. Oracle uses Fidelity as their TPA, and then the problem is Fidelity is one of the biggest institutional investors of Oracle. So, you know, somebody made a class action lawsuit about that. I don't know what the status is or if it's going to go anywhere. But listen. You know, I come from a village in Oceanside where everybody, you know, they don't care about appearances. So when you have a Board of Education member and two of his sons now work for the school district, he doesn't think anything wrong with it. And maybe these kids are perfect for the job, but it doesn't look right. And I've always felt that any type of, you know, if it quacks like a duck, if it looks like a duck, it's a duck.
Yes, sir.
Any type of transaction that looks that it's not on the board, it's a problem. Whether it was above the board or not, it just appearances are very, very important, especially to an ERISA litigator who wants to exploit that for litigation.
I've had, over the course of diligence and losing plans, I've had plan sponsors flat out tell me that they're getting a preferential rate on some other product from a bank, right? I've had clients tell me that they moved their retirement plan to a different brokerage firm, to a different consultant, because they were getting a discounted rate on the health plan.
Sure.
You know, it happens. happens all the time. And it's usually happening, at least in my experience, it happens with plans of substance. So if and when, you know, that's established through the courts, that's, you know, no bueno, that's a no-no, the ramifications of that are going to be fairly widespread.
Absolutely. So that's why, you know, everything that you do has got to be above board. And again, I think appearances matter. So even if it's above board, it still looks wrong. Avoid it. And again, if you're going to go around admitting that you're doing that, that's even more problematic. And you're just being honest and saying, this is what we did. That's a big problem.
Yeah. Yep.
Another one on the list. It doesn't matter who the TPA is. This is something that we will beat it down. We'll beat down a horse. Who you hire as a TPA for a plan sponsor really does matter. When we look at the compliance issues, you know, you're a TPA, you're a 360 administrator, I'm an ERISA attorney. You know, we know that the biggest errors, the most errors are caused by a TPA because they do the bulk of the work. So that's why, you know, the VCP issue or the DFVCP or the VFCP with the DOL, all these compliance programs, 90% of the errors are from, you know, dealing with TPA work. So it does matter who a plan sponsor does hire as a TPA.
It's a super important decision.
Exactly. Next one on the list is our plan is fine, nothing is going wrong. The assumption that if we don't know about it, if we don't hear about it, if nothing blew up, it's everything is fine. And not understanding that, you know, for my situation, you only discover a lot of times TPA errors when there's a change in the TPA and you find where the bodies are buried, or when there's a plan audit and then all of a sudden you discover all these errors. So yeah, a plan sponsor can't afford to just assume everything is going to form and going to plan. There's always that famous scene in Austin Powers where Scott Evil is telling Dr. Evil, what you're not going to watch him get killed? And, you know, Dr. Evil says, you know, why bother? I'm going to assume everything went to plan. Which is a common thing in the Bond movies. And a plan sponsor can't afford to assume everything went to plan.
No.
They got to review their plan regular intervals annually and see if whether the provider is doing a good job. I always talk about the plan sponsor who 25 years used a actuary who never produced the valuation report and gave the wrong advice that they could direct a check from the plan directly to another affiliate company, even though it was a participant, you know, the owner's benefit. So the DOL said, oh, you know, you're embezzling money from the plan, you know. And, you know, the plan sponsor's telling me, well, you know, I always trusted him and I can't believe this. Well, you trusted him and you didn't review what he was doing. So this is what happens. So that's important.
Yes, to say the least.
Next one on the one, who is a fiduciary? Who cares? I think that a plan sponsor really needs to identify the plan providers, needs to identify what fiduciary status they're taking, if any.
Sure.
You know, if they're a broker, understand that, you know, as of right now, they're not a fiduciary. If they're hiring a TPA, they need to understand that if they're not in a 316 setting, they're not a fiduciary. So the buck stops with the plan sponsor when something goes wrong, as far as being a fiduciary. So it's great to identify, you know, you go in the movie theater, like I did this morning watching Aquaman. You know what they say, identify the fire exits. Well, you know, a plan sponsor will identify who the plan fiduciaries are. Next one.
I couldn't agree with you more, especially as a 316.
Exactly. Next one on the list, another bad assumption. A corporate trustee limits a plan sponsor's fiduciary liability. You know, the trustees that we put in place, corporate trustees, we use them to get a limited scope audit for 401k plans or retirement plans, or we hire one because nobody for the plan sponsor wants to be a trustee. Outside of that, they don't protect the plan sponsor at all. They cut checks, they issue 1099s, and that's about it. They don't limit a plan sponsor's fiduciary liability.
Nope. Now, really, the only way, I mean, we've talked about it this 1,000 times, right? The only way is to outsource that liability, and even when you do, to, you know, one of the numbered ERISA folks, even when you do, you still have residual liability as a plan sponsor.
Exactly. Here's another one. The plan provider is great, and the plan sponsor doesn't have to consider a change. And again, that goes back to my clients who assume that the plan sponsor, the actuary who was working for 25 years was doing a good job. I think one of the biggest problems I've always found with plan sponsors, they got this weird concept of loyalty to plan providers. And you can't have loyalty that is blind. A loyalty has to be based on something. So, you know, if I use a TPA that was excellent and I knew that they were excellent because I've seen what other TPAs have done and I know their fees are reasonable, well, yeah, I can be loyal, but I can't be loyal to – I have to be loyal to, you know, not blind loyalty and not loyalty where it's actually going to hurt me as a plan fiduciary. So – you know, misplaced loyalty in plan providers is a thing, and it's a costly thing.
Yeah. No, look, your loyalty to the fiduciaries, I think, trumps your loyalty to a vendor.
Exactly. And that's really important. Next two, there are two concepts. I'll mention the two because they're the flip side of each. One is it's best to pick the most expensive provider, and of course, it's best to pick the cheapest provider. And fee disclosure regulations, you know, when they came out in 2012, you know, Chicken Little was telling us the sky was falling. The plan providers who were against it, they were saying that you're going to have a race to zero. We've had, the fees have gone down as a percentage of assets, but I think that that's competition. I haven't really seen a race to zero. But anyway, a plan sponsor is really mistaken and putting themselves in harm's way if they're picking a provider just because they're either expensive or the cheapest. You need to pick a provider because they are doing a good job and they charge a reasonable fee for the services provided. You don't have to pick the cheapest provider. You don't have to pick the most expensive plan provider.
No, you would, and the selection process should be documented. You know, have a reason, have a methodology why you went the direction you did. Right, it does need to be a little bit more expansive than it was the cheapest. That's probably a bad way to approach a search. But it is important, no matter where you land, that you have a documented process.
Right. And the next one on the list, that goes back to 404C, plan sponsor doesn't have to provide any education or investment advice to plan participants. And that's, to me, again, going back to 404C, you have to put participants in a position where they can make informed investment decisions. And just saying good luck to you and, like I said, my old law firm dishing out the Morningstar profiles and saying good luck. That's not the way to go, and that's going to give the plan sponsor limited protection. The more compliance you do with ERISA 404C in managing the fiduciary process and providing that investment education, the more protection a plan sponsor gets. It's a sliding scale, so it's not. And I used to always say it's not a suicide pact. The protection is limited to how much a plan sponsor is willing to comply with the parameters set forth by ERISA 404C. And, you know, that's again, that goes back to, you know, putting a prudent process in place and actually managing the process and putting participants in a position where they can actually make informed investment decisions. The difference between investment education and investment advice, education is just general. You're talking about investment concepts. You're not talking about the investments in the plan, aside from maybe identifying what they are. But investment advice is specific to advice to the plan participant based on their status now, status later, and giving them actual investment decisions, allocations, that sort of thing. And, you know, more and more plans are offering it, and, it's something to consider.
Absolutely. Wellness is going to be a huge thing in the future.
It's becoming more it's more and more of a thing, and I think it's going to be more and more of a thing that the plan, that the DOL is going to focus on.
Yeah, well, and that's another thing too, right? I mean, very rarely, the fiduciary rule was an exception, I think, and that was more killed by the benefit of the presidential change. But generally, once, you know, government starts to legislate or you know, steer, that doesn't get better. That just gets worse. There's just more of it.
Exactly.
Right? Like, the toothpaste can't get back in the bottle. So, yeah, I think it's important to get in front of these things and pay attention to it. It can be a real differentiator for you as a business owner, a plan sponsor, or an advisor.
Exactly. And last but not least for our list, fee disclosures, we don't really have to do anything with them. And I think there are too many plan sponsors that take that fee disclosure, the fee disclosures and treat them like I treat my bank's privacy notices that they mail out and put in the garbage or put in the back of the drawer. They actually have to go out and take those fee disclosures and, you know, shop around and see if the fees that are being charged are reasonable for the service to provide. And they can do that by looking at other providers or by using a service that, you know, can, you know, their books, you know, there are even, you know, books out there or services that they can use to benchmark their fees.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Advisors will do it as well for you. But, you know, if you want it completely objective, they're at Atari's point, their services. I will say this, we got out over, I want to say 13,000 pieces of mail associated with the notice distribution this season. I've gotten 3 phone calls so far about them. So I'm not sure what the percentage is on that, but or what to take from it, right? I mean, it could be folks are really informed already. I kind of doubt that. But 3, right? 3 people have gotten the forms and have called and said, what's this about?
Sure, of course. But that's really part of it. And, you know, that's going to be a problem. You know, I think knowing now with these disclosures coming out, you're more in harm's way than in the old days when you had no idea how much fees were being leveled against the plan. So that's that. So that's, you know, those are basically, again, those are topics that I covered in some articles. I should redo that article. It's actually a lot of fun and really just shows you that plan sponsors have these weird ideas and weird concepts. And I think it's also a big help to plan providers that are seeking these clients out and identifying the misconceptions that these plan sponsors may have. And, you know, you may get a business out of it. So it's important that that plan sponsors are really aware of reality rather than the misconceptions that and assumptions that they have.
Couldn't agree more, Ari. So, and it's a great way to, I think, close the year on our on the initial year of our podcasting.
That's right. Any New Year's plans?
I am going to stay home. I have the champagne already bought. And drink mimosas until I fall asleep.
Yeah, we stay home always. New Year's Day, we got tickets to go see Candy Cotopia, which is some cockamamie candy inspired thing in the city by Penn Station. I still have no idea what it is, but whatever.
Yeah, New Year's Day is a big day for us, Buckeyes. We're it's our coach's last game. We're in the Rose Bowl, so I'm going to be doing that New Year's Day, watching football.
You got it. So from all of us here at that 401k podcast, we wish everybody a happy and prosperous and healthy 2019.
Absolutely.
Take care.
Absolutely. Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Oh! side of the bed. And how I got to thinking about all those things you said about all the dead people and how to make you sick.